Succession number 23363, Reel 4.
Reg Best, Reel 4.
So we pressed on through the Falaise Gap, which became more pleasant after the early beginnings with the so much dead horses, dead Germans. Incidentally, they're rather alarming to see, looking at, I remember three or four lying beside the road, and somebody had been there, actually cut off the fingers, must have been their own people, of course, I would think, who had done that, just, of course, to get the chap's rings off his fingers. No doubt they looted every German they had time to stop and loot, I suppose. But some would do it. I don't think I would have fancied that, but they had to feel pretty ruthless. It's part of their job. Down at the river, when we finally reached, which of course took several days, if not more, and we got to the River Seine, of course, we're talking about, at Vernon, the infantry had to assault the river. There was the main bridge had been blown. It was sort of in a built-up V shape where it had been bombed. They used the bomb bridge, the infantry, to go over, and I forget which, it would have been the, I don't know if it's the Wilts, Hampshire, Wilts, Dorsets, whatever, made another crossing further down the river, down the river, using sort of midway stage of submerged island. It was pretty rough the other side because the Germans had left just one or two tanks, but they were in such a commanding position. The tanks were shelling the bridge, and the infantry trying to cross further down the river. Anyway, a bridgehead was eventually established. The Germans retreated, and the engineers, under fire a bit to start with, built a pontoon bridge first. Of course, they crossed the river just in boats, salt boats, to start with. But now they built a pontoon bridge. And later, the main Bailey Bridge, which was required to take the main part of the transport, tanks and so on, and the Guards Armoured Division. Tanks promptly led the way, I think, across the bridge, and of course they swept right on. We just stayed behind the 43rd, while the virtually the whole of the Second Army pressed on to Brussels, which they liberated, I think, with very little actual fighting. A few places on the way, of course, they had to clear odd pockets of Germans. And the 43rd hung around for a while the rest of the army were pressing on at Vernon-Vernonay. Life became rather pleasant for a few days. Remember, I made personal first acquaintance with a charming mademoiselle. Having gone out to inspect one of my field companies, of course, I'm being delayed on the way. And also, they said we could send a truck to Paris for the liberation, which I think was about the 25th of July. I rather fancy going myself, but I thought, well, I had to nominate somebody, so I gave somebody else a chance. Rather regretfully afterwards, I should have rather like to have been on that little job, but for once in a while I stood down and nominated a two who said it was a very interesting They came back same day, having joined up with the celebrations. De Gaulle came into Paris and this sort of thing. Of course, the Americans were actually the troops that took Paris. And which was, I think it was only about 25 miles from Vernon to Paris. I'm not sure. Anyway, this didn't last long. The weather was rather nice. I mean, it was rather pleasant. And we duly went on the bike, of course. And every time we moved, I had this basically bike to ride, but it became rather an advantage, really. In Vernon, they gave me a little red, white, blue flag, which I flew on the up from the handlebars of the bike. And then in Brussels, I was presented with the Belgian flag. Having previously collected, I didn't get no, that's right, those two. The Dutch flag came later, of course. But I got a very good reception from in Brussels. Deservedly, of course. A lot of other people have been before me. But I was able to hang around a bit and let the rest go on while the girls came out with their flowers and fruit and stuff, I think. Anyway, couldn't delay too long. Caught up with the rest of the our own little convoy. And we didn't stay in Brussels. Unfortunately, we moved on. I think it's called Louvain, the other side of Brussels.
Did you still have the gin palaces with you at that time?
No.
What sort of vehicles did you have?
Just a minute. What did we have? We had a command vehicle, but it was a rather sturdier affair. The field companies, they had scout cars, I forget who made them, with the wireless sets in. But we pressed on from Louvain. It was a rest while they sort of gathered their thoughts or whatever. The powers that be and moved us on while still in Belgium to, there's a place called Bourg-Leopold, wouldn't be sure, where they formed up, or massed up, a particular form to it, but they brought up more armour and 43rd was still there. It was mainly the 43rd and the Guards Armoured Division, and we were arranged in groups, and the plan was, as we became known as Operation Market Garden. About the 16th of September, I mean, it was a Sunday. Quite a memorable setup, because you could see that it was an open sort of heathland, I think. You could see a lot of the troops and the tanks formed up ahead of you. They put them in sort of groups of tanks and infantry together. As a plan, as you know, from Market Garden, was to now drive 60 miles as far as the infantry went, hopefully all the way to Arnhem. But there were bridges in the way which had to be taken to get there. One at Grave, another one at Son, I think, S-O-N. And the Americans, airborne, were to take the first ones at Son and and Graf, and a good job they made of it too, two very good American divisions. A bit critical of them, some of the other forces, but those 82nd and 101st Infantry Divisions were particularly good, and they made a wonderful job, particularly at Nijmegen, which of course was 50 odd miles on. But first of all, we had to get there, and the thing started with the airborne coming over at where our own troops there to take the airborne at Arnhem, of course.
Did you see the planes coming over?
Oh yes, very impressive. Yeah, all mass. And
what were your feelings at that time?
Well, we were there just to do as we were told, and it was exciting because the Dutch, as we went forward, the Germans weren't offering a lot of resistance, and if they were, it was being dealt with just in front of the 43rd, I think, really. And time we got to Eindhoven, the girls were on the streets again with a very good welcome. And I remember, didn't have a flag, so I just had a strip of orange which they tied around their neck or something, and two flags, a Belgian and a French flag, I carried with me on my bike. They got awfully messy and oily and whatnot, and I brought them home and kept them. I've lost them. I'm always sorry about that. Might come across them one day. So yet, I don't know. I wanted to keep them because I kept them right through the German war. But we pressed on and came to the 18th, but it was pretty tiring. So we were told, press on, press on, don't stop, nobody's to stop for anything. You've got to keep going. We've got to get to Arnhem to join up with the airborne. Hopefully cross the river, both at Nijmegen and then at Arnhem. And Montgomery's idea, rather optimistically, was that we would then sweep on to Berlin through the north of Holland.
What was the main thing that held you up?
Well, intermittently, there were halts, but we did just keep going in convoy. The main thing that held me up was I got very sleepy on my bike. I suppose we'd driven right through the first night, and then the next day, mustn't stop. It's all right. Some of the chaps in the trucks were able to swap the driving over and somebody else drive, but nobody else on my bike except me. So, and subconsciously, I was getting very tired. And at night, we just had the light, no rear lights, no headlights, of course, at all. Just a light that shone on the ground from underneath the trucks, and that. And you just followed the sort of light that made. And it was all, be careful on the bike not to run into the vehicle in front. And I didn't think I was doing too well. I suppose I'd run into near misses when I had to brake to stop doing so. So I decided that But nothing was coming back on the other side of the road. We went down on the right-hand side, of course, like everything was moving. And on the left-hand side of the road, it was clear. And there was nothing coming back because the order was, everybody go forward. but I forgot to think of one thing, and I think about half, it would have been about halfway between Eindhoven and Nijmegen. I was doing reasonably well on the left-hand side of the road, dozing, I suppose, dozing. I must have gone to sleep. And then wallop, I'd hit something. I'd hit an ambulance coming back the other way, which I hadn't considered a possibility.
Were the forward troops taking a lot of casualties?
No, not a lot. No, there wasn't much coming back, as I say, on that side of the road. So I didn't know I was going to doze off like that. But
how did they maintain the communications while you were on the move?
Didn't, I think. Wireless silence, probably, at that time. Yes. So it was, they didn't know how far we'd got on, or whatever, I suppose. I'm pretty sure it was a wireless silence until we got to Nijmegen. So I lay this ambulance lot, I suppose they found they got another casualty besides the ones they were bringing back. And I was dazed, or knocked out, I suppose. The whole thing's a bit vague even now. I remember sort of coming to my senses, having been laid out on a grass verge on the side of the road. And I remember them sort of talking then, and somebody saying, well, oh, he's all right. Leave him there. So they didn't put me in the ambulance, for which I'm very grateful. And I slowly came to, and I hadn't got anything, there was blood around, but it was only sort of superficial wounds, if they're wounds, superficial cuts and things or something. And so I thought, well, the bike was on its side, or perhaps I've got rid of the darn thing at last. And I left it there. And well, I'm not going to stay here looking helpless, because nobody else was going to pick me up or anything. I thought I'd sort myself out on my own again. And there was a nice looking bungalow on the other side of this grass verge. So I went, got my stain gun at the ready, and went to their front door and made myself known. Dutch people, of course, came to the door, and they were marvellous. They took me in, bathed the blood and whatnot that was around, and they said, well, they must have seen I was tired, and only sort of half with it, I suppose. So they put me on a bed, on sheets. I suppose it must have been about after midnight, I don't know. And I had a jolly good sleep for about 4 or 5 hours, maybe. I woke up and realised what then I was more with it, and decided I couldn't stay there. I'd was pressed on, so I think that finally they dragged my bike off the road or something and told me where it was. I went out to see if it started, which it did. It surprised me. Thought, oh well, I got my bike, just got to catch up with our engineer's headquarters, which I could do, of course, on a bike. I could pass through the others, and I think I drove pretty well all the way to Nijmegen before I caught up. Yes, it had stopped in Nijmegen. It was a case of picking up the divisional signs as to where to go, and I got there. But even now, I can't remember just where it was in Nijmegen. I always regret that, because when we went back 50 years later, I look forward to perhaps finding and recognising the people, because under that first stop where we were, I know they sort of were fating us and coming out with whatever they got to offer, which wasn't much. And we went on, but I never have found out where it was. Going back now, I remember things afterwards in Nijmegen, after we crossed the bridge and come back again. But that, no. But the 43rd, of course, they had to cross the bridge with the guard's armour were the first over. First tank, I think, was the Lord Carrington. Remember, he was Foreign Secretary or something. Later. Yeah. I think he was a major then, commanding a tank. He was the first over. And they'd stopped just on the other side of the bridge, which was subsequently proved to be a shame. They should have, and I think they said themselves, they should have been told to press on, in which case we might have got right through to Arnhem Bridge. And when we crossed, the infantry and the tanks had been held up at a place called Elst, halfway roughly, I think, between Nijmegen and Arnhem. The infantry only got down as far as Driel, D-R-I-E-L, on the river, where they were held up by German defences on the far side. And they hadn't got any boats to cross. We settled in fields between on what they called the island. That was the bit between Nijmegen and Arnhem. And it was very pleasant weather, I remember. We were picking fruit off the orchards and things around. And then there seemed no hurry. It was, something went wrong, I think, but right back at headquarters probably. We never realised the urgency in our small way at divisional headquarters. I mean, I was with the CRE and his staff there. I'm sure they didn't realise the urgency for a day or two.
Were you receiving any communications from the...
No, this was the big snag, that they lost communication, and which is where I feel Boy Browning, who was running the show, strangely, from, I think he was up with Dempsey and Montgomery on the road when. Not back in London, and he blamed the communications, lack of communication, but it was up to him. They practiced these things so many times in different things that were planned and never took place. It must have known they needed communications between London, I say London, I mean England, between England and where the airborne had landed, so as they could call up whatever reinforcements and so on that they needed. But they lost communication with our ground forces which were moving up on the road. But we, I remember everybody had to, who had a radio set, had to search the dial, searching, hoping we would pick up a signal that the chaps in the airborne might be making, which was eventually achieved with some quite minor lot receiving it, picking it up. But once they got a communication, of course it was better. But it did, I think we did that for at least a day until we got some sort of communication with them. Meanwhile, it held everything up when quick action was required. And those poor chaps who were trying to hold out at Arnhem Bridge never got the support that they needed. Now that they've got communication with the airborne, the thing was, they obviously told us that they urgently needed support. The thing was to get to them and get across the Niederrhein ran through Arnhem and the Waal through Nijmegen. We now were up on the Niederrhein. The thing was to get our own support across it, and the 43rd were very much in it. Trying to cross there, but they needed boats to do it, and to get the boats up to them. We had boats mixed up all the way from Belgium there, with every group, and it was the company called the Field Park Company, which held the boats. A signal was sent to them to urgently send boats up. For the infantry. I was in the headquarters truck there with the CRE, and there was a bit of a minor panic going on. He'd sent a signal to the Field Park Company to send the boats, which they'd duly sent out, and either it was wrongly coded or wrongly decoded, one way or the other. Anyway, they went to the wrong location, went right up through Elst, where the Germans promptly waved them on, and then took them prisoner, and the boats never got to the river at all, a point which was never much revealed in subsequent history of the advance there. But the major operation went on. Poles were dropped, but they didn't do a lot of good. They just dropped outside of the river, behind our own infantry. I think some were used in the crossing. The others just walked back, and they passed right by where. by our place, all looking so spick and span and smart, so very different from